From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. We're your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. On each program, we feature the ideas and stories of students, faculty, and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia.
This evening on the program, we speak to Craig Jones from UBC's Department of Geography. Craig is a PhD candidate, and he's just about to hand in his dissertation on war lawyers.
War lawyers have been around for centuries, but it wasn't until the first Gulf War in 1991 that they started to give legal advice on targeting operations, making them more intimately involved in life and death decisions in war.
Craig's research asks, what effect does the involvement of lawyers in targeting operations have on the conduct of late modern war? We met Craig in his office in the Geography Building. Your research finds that the interpretation of international law can actually almost enable violence in war. An act like bombing an apartment building, if it has military advantage, can be legal. How is this possible?
Well, if you look historically at this thing called the laws of war, which is a branch of international law, it is ultimately a balance between two opposing views. One is a humanitarian point of view and the other is a military point of view. And the military point of view has always stated since the 18th, 19th century, since these laws were made, that the military must be able to fulfill what they call its military objectives. It must be able to bomb places and do the things that it needs to do. And so ultimately, the branch of law has been pushed from a military point of view, because if you want to conduct war, then it needs to be legal. There's no point in outlawing it, because then the law would have nothing to say. So there's no point in it being illegal. So the military has always advocated for the legality of killing. And that's just unfortunately what the laws of war are. I think the problem is how we perceive the laws of war. We don't think that it should be legal to kill. So it's a question of perception. But I think most of us are just wrong in how we understand what the laws of war do, unfortunately.
So more specifically, because we would think that international law would protect human rights, or that's the humanitarian angle, but there are case examples that you describe in your work of lawyers in a room, or a military lawyer sitting with a commander, a military commander, and they're able to find ways, or rather the lawyer is able to say, that's not illegal, and the military commander is able to kill innocent people. Again, how?
Yeah, well, that's right. Again, so the military starts from something in the law called military necessity, and it basically says that, you know, as long as we are targeting a military objective, let's say a building, a Hamas building or Hezbollah building or Al-Qaeda building, you're allowed to go and do that. The law also says that if there are people in the way, civilians in the way, let's say that the a Hamas building is next door or is in the middle of a residential neighborhood with a school next door, well, if you bomb that building, there's a chance that you may kill those civilians, those children in the building next door. That's called proportionality, and is all that the military needs to do, is all the lawyer needs to do, is do a form of calculation. In the US, it's a very kind of mathematical equation that they do with something called collateral damage estimation methodology, whereby they measure the effects of dropping a bomb. And they might say, okay, yeah, we're going to kill some civilians in the next door building, but the military objective, like killing this Hamas target, these people in the Hamas building that may be having a meeting, is so important that it's worth killing the civilians. And basically the law said that that's absolutely legal. It's what they call collateral damage. Collateral damage is a euphemism for killing civilians and destroying civilian objects. But that's what the law allows. It always has done. It's called proportionality. The strange thing about proportionality, and we're talking about killing civilians, is that there's no objective way to measure how many civilians it's okay to kill. So the Israeli military comes up with different calculations. The one lawyer I talked to came up with a number of about 3, or actually an average of 3.14. The US military, at the height of the bombing campaign in 2003, their number was 29. If they killed 29 civilians, then it was okay. If they killed 30 or more, or if they thought that they were going to kill 30 or more, then they had to get approval from the Secretary of Defense or the President. Today, that number has changed in Syria and Iraq. It's closer to about 10. At one point last year, it was zero. And so these are highly subjective determinations. And so when we think about the law, we think of it as an objective kind of arbiter of conflict, as something that might come in and reveal some truth. But it's not. It's a threshold kind of thing. It can be variously interpreted. And my argument is that it's very aggressively interpreted, specifically by the US and Israel, to enable them to do what they want to do, even if that unfortunately means killing civilians.
You've found that lawyers are often put in the awkward position of having to, or it seems like they're having to make this decision where it should be the military. How do lawyers negotiate that? What is their job?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we should be clear that technically speaking, it's never the job of a military lawyer. These people are also called judge advocates or JAGs. It's never their responsibility, formally speaking, to make any kind of decision. They're what's called advisors, legal advisors, and like any attorney-client relationship, the client can make a decision, i.e. the military being the client. The responsibility of the advisor is merely to give them advice, is to say, consider this option, this might be illegal, this might be dangerous, this might not be politically expedient. If we bomb an embassy, for example, that's dangerous. So they give a series of advice, verbal advice and written advice, and it's up to the commander to make the decision. Unfortunately, and I think inevitably, as the role of the lawyer has developed historically, especially over the last decade or so, the law has become so important to the conduct of military operations. When we think about questions of legitimacy and when things go wrong, it's in the media and it looks so bad. So commanders have become what they call risk averse. They don't want to be getting in trouble. They don't want to be killing civilians. And so they turn increasingly to the lawyer to get this advice. But then it becomes not advice because, well, when you're given prudent advice by a lawyer who says, you know, yes or no, essentially, then that becomes a de facto and a kind of veto power over the future of targeting operations. And that's what my research has found. It found increasingly that although formally they would never admit to saying that we become decision makers, they're actually a very key part of the decision-making apparatus. And I would argue for all intent and purposes, they've become decision makers, although they're not the only decision makers.
And in the media, when we read or when we even talk about war and say things like that action, that airstrike in Syria, for example, breaks international law, how is that not helpful when it might not actually be breaking international law?
Yeah, well, that's another interesting question. I think it's a powerful thing to be able to say that a state or a non-state actor, let's say the Assad government, has broken international law by bombing a hospital, let's say. I think that's very powerful for human rights organizations, for academics, for people interested in, you know, protecting humanity. It's very powerful to say that because it's a huge tool to delegitimize whoever you're calling the war criminal. I think it has a huge rhetorical and political power when you say that, which is why people say it, which I think is important. But we're also making a legal claim when we say that. We're engaging in illegal discourse, and in effect, we're saying that we know the law. In order to call someone a war criminal, we're saying that we know the law. The law is X, and they've breached X, and therefore they're guilty of committing a war crime. If we engage in that kind of debate, then it becomes difficult, one, because I think not a lot of us know the law, two, because when we do, we misunderstand it, and three, because we have to admit, when we engage in this legal argument, that people have different ways of interpreting the law. So what we might think of as a war crime, let's go back to the example about them bombing the hospital, the law changes when, for example, let's say the opposition of the Syrian government are using that hospital as a shelter, or perhaps they're storing weapons. And in international law, that changes from a hospital, which is, you know, something we should obviously protect and is sacrosanct, to a military objective because, well, there are bad guys inside, and so now we can bomb them. That is what the law says. So when you engage in this kind of accusation of war criminality and illegalities, it's all well and good, but you have to be willing that there's going to be someone on the other side, be it the Assad government lawyers, the military lawyers, government lawyers, saying, well, actually, this is how we interpret the law. And, you know, a lot of humanitarians are going to lose that argument, or at least we're going to then get engaged in a legal battle, which might be a bit more difficult to win than we once thought by merely just calling them war criminals.
So what's another option? Like, what can be done? What needs to be done?
I think, you know, despite what I just said about these accusations, I think it is a good thing to engage in this legal discourse and legal arguments, because it's a powerful tool for delegitimizing whoever you want to accuse. But I think that there must be other methods. I mean, you know, I'm a firm believer in diplomacy and diplomatic options before we start dropping the bombs. I think when we look to kind of quote-unquote humanitarian situations like in Syria, there's a lot of talk about, well, whether the US, whether Canada should go in and drop bombs, and indeed they are dropping bombs. I don't think that should be the first option. So hopefully, my dream would be that we don't have to make accusations of illegality, that we can pursue diplomatic options and do other things. But we need to engage in all forms of kind of political critique, and not just legal critique, I think an ethical critique, because whether you drop bombs and you know, destroy a hospital or kill a whole family with civilians, as has happened, and you know, I've talked to lawyers who've made those decisions, it shouldn't matter at the end of the day whether that's legal or not. The ultimate thing is it's wrong, and it's morally unjustifiable by any measure, any reasonable measure, even though it may be legal. And so I think that the ethical critique and the moral critique, as well as the political critique, is as important and should always come along with the legal critique.
You're turning your research into a book, The War Lawyers. What are you hoping to accomplish with it?
My real objective, beyond you know, generally that people will read it and be interested, is to reach beyond academic audiences, something I've been trying to do with my work in the last year or so, and something that I want to increasingly get into. Academic audiences are very important, but I think that people outside of academia find my research as interesting or more interesting than academics, because these are things that are happening in the real world. These are real issues. These are life and death decisions. And one doesn't have to be, nor shouldn't have to be, an academic in order to understand them. So, you know, everyday people, my family, my friends are interested, undergraduates are interested. So I'd like to be able to engage in a conversation with people outside of academia, because, again, we don't have to be academics to understand these issues. They're important. And yet I think, you know, for me as an academic, having had the luxury to study these things for several years, I feel informed about it to engage in conversations and bring people into those conversations, whilst also not being a kind of ivory tower academic about it. That's probably the most important thing to me.
Craig Jones, thank you for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much.
That was Craig Jones from UBC's Department of Geography speaking about his research on war lawyers. The topic is his PhD research, and it's soon to be a book as well. Craig is also conducting postdoctoral research on how the sick and injured from the wars in Syria and Iraq access medical care in regions where the medical infrastructure has been almost completely destroyed. That project's called Precarious Journeys: Injury Care and War in the Middle East.
You can learn more about Craig's research at warlawspace.org and about his teaching at megeog.org. That's megeog.org. Craig is this week's guest speaker at the Geography Colloquium series. That's happening tomorrow, Tuesday, November 29th at 12:30 p.m. You can visit UBC's Department of Geography website for details about that event.
If you missed some of that interview, you can visit our website at artsonair.com, where we'll be posting the podcast a bit later today. You can also follow us on Twitter at artsonair.
We're going to bring things a little closer to home now. Our next guest focuses his research on housing right here in our city.
Nathan Lauster is an associate professor in the sociology department here at UBC. His book, The Death and Life of the Single Family House, Lessons from Vancouver on Building a Livable City, was published just last month.
You know, housing affects everyone in this city, from students to families to people in poverty. We went to visit Professor Lauster in his office to get his views on housing in Vancouver and to ask him why houses come with so much emotional baggage in our culture. What do single-family houses represent in Canada and here in Vancouver as well?
Well, here in Vancouver, they represent something unattainable for most people at this point. In terms of more broadly speaking, across Canada, and for that matter, across North America, I think that they represent a number of things, culturally speaking, including being a success in life, including being an adult for some people. So I talked to many people who talked about, you know, like, yes, you don't really feel like you're an adult until you have a house. And also including being a good parent, which adds a real moral component that some people feel like, you know, they're not taking care of their kids well unless they have a sort of single family house. So I think in that sense, there is a cultural resonance of the single family house that's really important for some people, not everyone. And that's something that's interesting that I find in talking to people for the book.
Do you think that's changing, that sense of being a grown up and a good parent means owning a house?
Well, I think in Vancouver in particular, we've made a lot of room to make that kind of change feasible. So a number of people that I talked to actually rejected, out and out rejected the idea that a single family house is where they wanted to live and or where they should live, and rejected it as well for the idea of their children, right? So I had people talking about, you know, I love the fact that my child, by being in a more dense urban environment, can walk down the street and be exposed to cultural opportunities that they wouldn't have in a suburb or in a rural area, for that matter, that's something distinct that a city has to offer. And other people I spoke with were also quite frank about not necessarily knowing how not living in a house was going to work out for them, but ultimately enjoying it. So another person talked about the fact that in her condo building, which we often think of as these impersonal spaces, everybody in the hall left their doors open, the kids ran back and forth between the units, and it actually created this incredible communal feel that she would feel terrible to ever leave. And it had caused several of her neighbors who had thought about leaving to ultimately decide, no, we want to stay here because this is where our kids have this real sense of community. So I think these kind of things are possible once we open up the alternatives to the single family house, that people will really find that these can be great places to live. And ultimately, I think that's something that Vancouver is providing to the rest of the continent, effectively, is an example of how we might make this work for a lot of people, that we might start building our cities differently. Single-family houses ultimately have a lot of negatives that come with them that we should also take into account as we're building our cities.
What are those negatives?
Well, first off, single-family houses take up an enormous amount of land. This is one reason they're very expensive, but it's also a real net negative for the environment in terms of all the different ecosystems that get displaced in the process of using that land for residential use. The biggest uses that we displace are agricultural, and of course displacing them around here locally means that ultimately somebody else somewhere else has to take up that production, and that further extends the reach of redevelopment out into ecosystems that had been wild. So we have all kinds of ecosystems that are lost through this process. Also, added to that is the energy use. Houses are much more energy intensive. They eat a lot more energy up than other sorts of dwellings. And that has to do, of course, with having no shared walls and having a lot of space, for the most part, that single-family houses have in terms of heating and cooling costs. And then they encourage us to drive cars because, by and large, houses are surrounded by other houses. So to get anywhere, you have to get in a car to get anywhere interesting. So if you add up the residential energy use and the automobile use in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, that's a huge chunk of our greenhouse gas emissions as a country in Canada. So we really get to a point where we can think this is something we can change and that will make the whole world a better place to live. Now that's the environmental costs. The other thing that we can add on to that are that houses end up sapping a certain amount of our urban vitality by keeping people living in much more privatized spaces. They don't have the same sort of public spaces that they can go and interact with other people. The more we celebrate and protect single-family houses as the ways that everybody should live, the less sort of urbanity we create and the less urban vitality. And that also has implications for things like democracy itself. The more we lose those spaces where we interact with people who are different, the less empathy we have, the less tolerance we have, the more likely we are to move towards less collective modes of governments in that context. And then, of course, it's not even that good for us in terms of health, because by and large, if there's no place to walk or bike nearby, then people tend to not integrate that into their everyday routines. And then, of course, and this is especially visible in the context of Vancouver, it's bad for poor people because nobody can afford to get into single-family houses. They're just very expensive ways to house people. And by reserving so much land around our cities for single-family houses and only those kinds of structures, we end up really constraining the space where poor people can afford to live. And so we put them in competition with the middle-class people who are also interested in living in the city, which is where we see the gentrification literature really focusing its attention. I think one of the things that's absent, for the most part, from the gentrification literature is the realization that the constraints that we have on urban space are there predominantly because we have walled urban space off with single-family house reserves, what I like to call this great house reserve, and that prevents urban space from expanding.
So how is Vancouver doing with its housing strategy? What are the problems?
Vancouver's working on a lot of these problems. It hasn't by any means solved them, right? Affordability is still a major issue across Vancouver. But it's done a couple of things that have been different from other cities. One, it's really tried to make a lot of different urban options available to people and tried to make them more livable. So high rises, low rises, townhouses, etc. The city has tried to really build these in the places that in many cases used to be other urban uses, especially industrial uses. All around False Creek, for example, used to be heavily industrial. We've replaced almost all of that at this point with residential uses. But you really see this emphasis on building lots of these things and making them livable. On the outskirts of Vancouver, of course, we had the provincial government famously come in and introduce the Agricultural Land Reserve. And that set aside most of that land so that single-family houses and this great house reserve I talk about could no longer expand outward. It runs into this agricultural land, which is protected. So that's quite distinct. And then I think that that combination of those two things, building lots of things in the urban core and building this protected agricultural land reserve, as well as the park system around the metro area, really explain most of how Vancouver has transformed itself differently from other cities. And then we also have changed the bylaws, which specify what a single-family house even means in terms of these single-family residential neighborhoods. So the RS zones, which are these protected single-family zones, now enable secondary suites and laneway houses. All of a sudden, you can have three households living on lots that theoretically are reserved for one. And that's right there in the name. But we've sort of sneakily said, you can get three people in here, three units at least, three households. So that's another change that Vancouver has accomplished. And all three of these ways of building around these great house reserves that we've set up across North America could really be picked up and moved to other locations where they could also inform building our cities in a different and ultimately more just, more environmentally sustainable way.
You live in a townhouse, is that right?
I do, yes. When I started writing the book, I lived in a 700-square-foot apartment, and then by the time I finished, I had moved to a townhouse in the Arbutus Village area.
And was it hard for you to come to terms with the fact that townhouse living was going to be the way your family moved forward?
You know, I think initially, when I first moved to Vancouver, both my partner, who I met here, and I, you know, we came from the States. We had this idea that, yes, we probably would end up living in a single-family house at some point, but it was kind of a vague expectation. So I think, you know, one way to understand me writing this book is to figure out, you know, how I learned to love living without a single-family house. And I think that's definitely part of it, that coming to terms with that on my own part also helped me see how Vancouver is building things differently and what the potential for that is as providing us with great ways to live. So on the one hand, yes, I do live in a single family, in a townhouse. On the other hand, I'm actually surrounded in terms of the part of the city where I live by all these single family houses. And every time I go by them, I keep thinking at this point, why isn't there more density being constructed here? Because a lot of them are new houses that just keep going up. And at this point, only millionaires can get in there. And it's the city, through these regulations, that are doing that, that are preventing anybody from millionaires from living in large swaths of Vancouver. To me, that's just fundamentally unjust.
Why is there so much pushback against densification in Vancouver?
It's a really good question. I think it has to do, A, with many people still having this cultural value attached to the single-family house, and then, B, neighborhood opposition. And we've built a lot of our city building and planning around neighborhoods getting a greater voice in terms of the direction of their own neighborhoods. Neighborhood organizations often form around providing input into these questions of how the neighborhood should be allowed to change. And on the one hand, that's great. It's good to get this feedback from the people who live there. That's important. But on the other hand, especially when you have neighborhoods that are built around social exclusion, and historically speaking, zoning was set up in part to keep out the poor, when you have neighborhoods built around social exclusion and you only pay attention to the people who live there in terms of how that neighborhood is ever going to develop in the future, you're going to get more social exclusion. So I think we need to rethink the ways that we plan our cities in order to incorporate the voices of people who have been marginalized from that discussion to a much greater extent. And that's where I think the city is tentatively trying to figure out how to do this in a new way. And you have some private groups that have sprung up, including things like Abundant Housing Vancouver, this organization which says, we're going to go to all these planning and rezoning meetings and make sure that people know that we need more housing to fill in that gap of, right now, the voices that have been marginalized and excluded from the discussion. So we'll see where that goes.
Fascinating. Thank you. On a personal note, I'm in a similar situation to you. I've got two kids. We started off in a 900-square-foot condo, and then we moved to a townhouse, but we actually went back to renting. And so that's a whole other layer of conversation, what it feels like to be a renting parent. But your book really resonated with me in just that feeling of being a grown-up and being a good parent. Mm-hmm. You buy your kid a house, and we've opted completely out of that, and we feel like rebels in a lot of ways for it.
And to some extent, being a rebel is kind of exciting, right? I mean, that's the plus side of that, you know. And a lot of people that I talk with actually describe like feeling rebellious, in some cases feeling rebellious but still wanting this house and trying to figure out what that meant, where that was coming from. But in other cases, being like, no, I'm a rebel, I'm not gonna let anybody tell me how to live, in terms of what I think is best for my family. And to some extent, more power to them. I mean, like, that diversity in terms of figuring out new ways to live is part of what I think is exciting about Vancouver.
Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Professor Nathan Lauster from the Sociology Department. His book is The Death and Life of the Single Family House, Lessons from Vancouver on Building a Livable City. It's great that he's really digging into this subject. It's such an emotionally fraught topic in Vancouver these days.
I, for one, still rent and probably will for a while. The only time I feel like I should be buying in, though, well, if I had the money, is when I think about family, starting one, having one of my own. But I like his points about community making in certain kinds of housing. I grew up in a rural area, pretty removed from any neighborhood, so I can see the benefits of both.
Yeah, for sure. No matter where you live, there's going to be trade-offs. Nathan's book really highlights that and some of the positives that come with less common choices in housing. And it's nice to hear that he thinks Vancouver's making some of the right decisions around this issue as well.
You've been listening to UBC Arts on Air on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We are Rachel and Brittany, and we are planning our show, Arts on Air, into 2017. So if you've got a Faculty of Arts story to share, please send us an email at artsonair.info@gmail.com.
You can stay in touch with us over Twitter as well, @artsonair. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.